Hello, 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 and welcome to episode 3 of Radio Nerd. I almost forgot the name of the podcast for a second there. That is slightly embarrassing. This is a little bit of a different kind of episode. We're going to do some housekeeping first, but then it's going to be more of a talk. A conversation. Well, everything's a conversation about these kinds of topics, but this one's more of an off-the-cuff, a little bit less researched than other ones. Not to say that this isn't researched. This is more based on personal experiences in some ways. I'm talking about a few different pieces of media, and I personally have had experience with all these pieces of media, whether it's books that I've read or movies that I've seen and so on and so forth. But we're going to be talking about something that doesn't really have a term, but that's sort of exemplified in the title of this episode, which is Oops, Did You Miss the Point? Before that, we're going to do a little bit of housekeeping. Reading week just passed by. Yay. Congratulations for everybody who's listening, who's a student. You got through it. You got your break. I personally got the opportunity to go on vacation to Vancouver, which was incredible. It was a really great experience. There's something about Vancouver and BC as a province that appeals to me in many ways. Their approach to reconciliation is something that I think is severely lacking in Ontario and in a lot of provinces on the eastern side of Canada, perhaps all of our provinces in general. I can't really think of any other province that is that celebratory of Indigenous culture and Indigenous history, as well as being, you know, committed to a lot of aspects of reconciliation. There was a monument there that was created for the recent finding of unmarked graves at numerous residential schools across the country. And it was powerful and very striking to see that, and to see that that's being put on display in such a prominent location. It really spoke a lot to the general feeling that I get out there, that people care about these things a little bit more deeply. And I don't always get that here. Not to say that people don't care here, just to say that I feel like a lot of people in Ontario would rather ignore the past than reflect on it. That's my own personal feelings, of course. That's not necessarily what is actually the case. It's just sort of the feeling that I got. And there were genuine differences between the city. There was also a very artistic feel that I got from Vancouver as compared to someplace like KW, which feels very much like a student academic town, as opposed to Vancouver felt very much like, you know, a place where people would make works of art. That also might be because I went to an art gallery and a couple of museums, and I was specifically looking for those things. But who knows? Whatever. We also now have an Instagram, finally. Thankfully, Instagram is not down this week when I attempted to sit down and make a Instagram page for the podcast. But it is up and ready to go. The name is @radio_nerdWLU on Instagram. So, like I said, obviously it's on Instagram. It's on Instagram. I don't know. I'm rambling at this point. It's exciting. It's kind of cool. I have no idea how to run like a fan or an Instagram page for something like a podcast. I barely know how to run my Instagram page, to be perfectly honest with you. But here we are. It's a learning experience. So I'm going to make posts probably each week, at least when the new episode goes up. I'll make a post then. And maybe random posts intermittently throughout the week. Yeah, because that'll be something interesting to do. As well, for housekeeping, I have a little bit of news with regards to some earlier topics. The first episode, it was on LGBTQ plus representation. We have a new representative, apparently. Superman's son. I can't remember his name. John or something like that. Or Tom. It doesn't matter. Anyways, he's the new Superman in DC Comics. And again, DC does a representation of someone who is queer. And he's bisexual. He has a has a boyfriend in the comics. And it's really awesome. I'm glad that at least DC is embracing this idea of representation. I feel like DC has in the past been both good and bad with those kinds of things, with regards to very insensitive characters, but also with regards to having really good characters. One thing that comes to mind is Midnighter, and I can't remember the other superhero's name, but they're two gay men who have been in a very long-term relationship, and they're pretty big characters within DC. Apollo is his partner. I can't remember if they're married or not. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Anyway, so Apollo and Midnighter, who are the first sort of openly gay superheroes within print. Marvel has Northstar, who is an X-Men, I believe. He's a Canadian character, actually, if I remember correctly. and yeah, there's it was originally in Wildstorm and is now in DC. But the fact that they're expanding that to their more mainstream heroes like Superman and you know, a member of the Batman's extended sort of family there is I think really good. It's a really good move on their part, and I think it's good for telling new stories, and that's something that if you've ever read comic books, can be difficult from time to time, telling a new story. Telling a new story that's actually a good story, I guess, as opposed to a rehash of old material that's, you know, kind of dry. But anyways, it's good news. It's awesome. Maybe we'll revisit this later down the line. Like I said, I wanted to revisit representation with regards to not just LGBTQ representation, but also representation of, you know, Black, Indigenous people and people of color, as well as women. But yeah, that would require someone who is from those groups, I think. I think it's important to include someone. We always open here to having someone come on and talk about that. If that's something that you're passionate about talking about and that's something you're comfortable talking about, definitely feel free to reach out either on the email, which is radionerdwlu@gmail.com, or at the new Instagram, which again is radio_nerdwlu. So yeah, I guess that takes care of all of the housekeeping for today. Into the actual topic, and this one's a little off the cuff. I came up with it while I was in Vancouver and talking with a friend of mine that I went out there to visit, and we were talking about people missing the point of big parts of major fandoms and of different pieces of literature and media in general. And sort of that disconnect between the core point that some stories seem to have and the way that some fans, specifically I'm thinking of right-wing fans here, take the point in some ways. So we're going to be talking about sort of three different issues here, two very big fandoms, and then we're going to be talking about a genre. So we're going to start with Star Wars. And that's always a landmine to start on because, well, people have very concrete and very immovable ideas of what Star Wars should be and what Star Wars can be, as we saw with the new trilogy and how some of the movies push to change what could be Star Wars, and some of them pushed to do the same thing that Star Wars has always been. And I feel like the reason why the trilogy itself was kind of, you know, a bit of a flop with regards to, like, big fans of Star Wars, which I would say I'm a pretty big fan of Star Wars, is because there was that disconnect. On top of the fact that it was basically not planned out, and how do you go into doing a trilogy and not plan anything out is sort of mind-boggling in some ways. Anyways, back on point. What we're going to be talking about is Empire fetishization, right? And this is something that you see a lot. You see people who, you know, are like, oh, the Empire's really cool, and they're all in love with them, love the stormtroopers, love everything. And we're going to talk about how that's missing the point of a lot of the original trilogy specifically. In many ways, the sequel trilogy sort of addresses that some in some ways. I think you have to dig a little deeper to see how it addresses it. The First Order is very much so, in my opinion, a good example of Empire fanboys. You know, they're the neo-Nazis to the Nazi regime that was the Empire, because that's what the Empire was. The Empire was a fascist regime ran by space wizards, but fascist at the end of the day. And watching documentaries on it where George Lucas talks about what his intentions were, you know, it was very clear from the get-go that his intention was to paint the Empire as a fascist regime. From the use of the idea of stormtroopers to Darth Vader and other Imperial agents using helmets that are very much so designed using the same sort of aesthetic and also the same sort of like design principles as the helmets that the Nazis used in World War II. Stormtroopers themselves was a term used for specific regiments within the Wehrmacht, which is the German not army at the time of the Nazis. The appearance is supposed to evoke these ideas in us, you know, whether it's, you know, the uses of black and red with regards to the lightsaber and the, you know, whether it's Vader himself or later on the Emperor. Seeing like these contrasting colors are supposed to evoke in us these cultural and, I guess, psychological like memories in many ways. These are supposed to evoke these ideas that this is a, these are bad guys, and they're doing terrible things. And, you know, on top of that, you also see this in a lot of the depictions of who was in the Empire. Now, that's not to say that Star Wars, the original trilogy, is very white and already has those problems. But seeing people like Tarkin or some of the other Imperial high-ranking people that we see over the course of the film, we are seeing very clearly a very white dominated culture, and delving into some of the things that are a little deeper, you find out that the empire is very humanocentric and almost like a human supremacist organization, which again evokes those ideas of Nazis, fascism, nationalism, and these ideas, right? So the problem becomes is when you get people who are fans who are like, these things look cool. I'm going to take the Empire's insignia and tattoo it on my arm. Now, there's a problem with tattooing the icon of a Nazi analog on your arm. It's basically like taking a fantasy swastika and putting it on yourself in many ways. And I don't think that everybody who does it is necessarily a Nazi, but or a neo-Nazi, or, you know, a terrible person, right? Maybe they just like the aesthetic, but it's the aesthetic that drives things, you know? There's a reason why the Nazis got, like, Ralph Lauren, and I think it was Ralph Lauren. It's a famous clothes designer to design their outfits, you know? They wanted to look impressive, and they wanted to, at the immediate get-go from when you saw them, they wanted you to think that they were better than you, because that was a key part of their ideology. And the same is true for how George Lucas took those ideas and designed the Empire. And the Empire is supposed to be a very clear parallel between these regimes that we've had in our world and the world that that George Lucas created within Star Wars. The problem here is that people glorify it, right? There's a big difference between a nerd who dresses up as a stormtrooper for a convention and somebody who, like, talks about how great the Empire was, right? There's differences, right? It's the difference between somebody who is a military reenactor who is playing the part of a Southern soldier within military reenactments of the Civil War in the United States, and somebody who puts a Southern cross in the back of their pickup truck. This is the difference here, right? The difference between somebody who has an appreciation for history, or in the case of Star Wars, the fandom, and somebody who is attempting to glorify what is essentially pseudo-Nazi iconography in a way that doesn't make them seem like they're doing it, which is very problematic and is missing the point of the narrative. George Lucas created a story that was very much about resisting rigid forms of power and embracing democratic ideals. You know, forgetting the new trilogy and the problems that the Jedi Order bring into the mix, what Luke stands for is that regular person, that regular citizen who is living off in the fringes and realizes that this terrible entity is terrorizing people all over the galaxy. And he can do something about that. And so he stands up and he does something about it. It's actually a very left-leaning, you know, look into things. At least this is how I'm reading it, of course. Like, you can interpret things in different ways, and that's perfectly fine too. But I've always read it as a very left-leaning piece of media. But enough about Star Wars. Let's get into our next one. We're going to be talking about a personal favorite of mine, which is Lord of the Rings. There's a lot of problematic things with Tolkien. We're going to cover a few of them here. We're going to talk about some of the messages that Tolkien has in Lord of the Rings, which people seem to miss. And some of the messages that they don't seem to miss, which even Tolkien himself struggled with towards the end of his life. I'm a huge Tolkien fan. Tolkien is probably one of my favorite fantasy authors of all time. Possibly just my favorite fantasy author. I mean, I'm staring at a picture of, or a map of Middle-earth that I have up on my wall behind my computer. And I have many of his collected books, along with some of the things that were written put together by his son and edited, Christopher Tolkien, after his death. And there's a lot of works that he did. He created an incredible world, and there's a reason why it stands up. But there are problems within his world. Problems that he has somewhat addressed and he's talked about. But let's get back to the core issues. So what Tolkien created fundamentally was a piece of anti-industrialist and anti-war literature. Tolkien himself was in World War I. We think that we, as in people who have studied his life a little bit more in depth than, say, just reading his books, that he probably had PTSD from his effects during World War I. He got discharged early. The reasoning that they gave was something to do with the flu. I can't remember the exact words, but the wording that's used is very much, it's the wording that doctors who had become very aware of what PTSD was would use to allow people to return home so that they didn't have to continue participating in the war when it was actively inhibiting them. Tolkien lost friends. He went through literal hell. He went through what was essentially an apocalypse in our time. You know, the amount of people that died and the hellish landscapes that developed during the course of the First World War would later inspire his depictions of Mordor. And Frodo, in many respects, is Tolkien, and is Tolkien and people like Tolkien who went through the war and kept on having to live. And the story is about someone who just wants to stop fighting. It doesn't want to fight for something anymore, and they want to rest. They want to be able to put down the gun, put down the sword, and stop. And Frodo ends up doing that in the end, and he goes to the lands of the Valar in the west, or in the, yeah, the west. And it's a really good point. It's something that I think is missed by a lot of people, and they're like, oh, he got a reward in the end. But it's not really a reward. It's just what he needs, you know? It's an idea of, in many ways, positive mental health, something that we still struggle with today. The anti-industrialist messages sort of come from depictions that we see of both Isengard and Mordor, of these, you know, ideas of destroying the nature around us to create machines of war. And again, this is a thing that he saw in World War One. You know, he participated in the Battle of the Somme, which is one of the, like, most horrific battles in modern history. You know, I can't even imagine what it would have been like to go through the hell that was. And he used that to fuel his imagination and his dislike of many things within there. Tolkien himself was very much so a student of fantasy. He loved the tales of Northern Europe, specifically the Finnish Kalava. I can't remember the name of it, but it's essentially the Finnish sort of tales and myths, along with things like Beowulf and the poetic Edda, and these sort of stories that had been written down long after the cultures that had loved them had gone away. But Tolkien was very much a he was also a Catholic, and he had a very clear sense of what was right and what was wrong, and his ideas of what is right and what is wrong come through in many ways in Lord of the Rings. But there are problems there too, and there are problems that people focus on. One that comes to mind is the orcs and Uruk-hai and extended sort of evil races of Mordor and Sauron and sort of the dark powers. This is something that Tolkien, reading some of his biographies, he struggled with this later on in life. He struggled with the fact that he had created someone that was he created like groups of people that were irredeemably evil, because that opens up parallels in our own world for denying the existence of other people because of what they look like. And as a Catholic himself, he didn't believe that any person was good or evil, and that they had both of those capacities inside of themselves. And there was always the chance for redemption within God and all of those things. The other sort of problematic thing that we come to, and this came out more when Tolkien started publishing his books around the time right before World War II, the idea of the Men of the West and the men who had aligned with Sauron. And you see this somewhat in the movies too, which is problematic because the movies are pretty recent. But you also see them when you're reading the books. And these are the Men of the East and the Men of the South. The people from Harad and the people from the East. They never really... I can't remember what the name of the Eastern area is. But it doesn't matter. And these are the people who are riding the giant elephants, or the people that Sam and Frodo hide from when they're at the gates of Mordor within the second movie. The idea that people from specific areas of the world are evil, or perhaps more susceptible to falling to evil, as opposed to the good men of the West who are descended from basically super godlike men from an Atlantean analog. This goes back deeper into Tolkien lore. But this became a problem, and one that Tolkien fiercely defended against. The Nazis sent him letters wanting to know if he was Jewish so that they could publish his books, because they wanted to use his books and his ideas to advance their own skewed ideas about where white people came from, and the fact that white people are in their idea that white people had a mythological origin that made them better. And Tolkien sent back letters, you know, basically being like, I'm not going to prove that I'm not Jewish, because it doesn't matter to me if you don't publish my books, because you are terrible. And he had some choice words. I wish I could remember the specific words he said about Hitler, because they were hilarious. But he talked about a lot of these things, and he wasn't alone. He was a member of a society along with people like C.S. Lewis, Inklings, I believe they were called. It was a group of writers, and they were all people who very much so loved the myths and folklore of their homeland, which was the UK, and by extension, Anglo-Saxon sort of culture. And they loved it in a way that was not racist, and was, you know, a caring about the cultural legacies of your people, and their culture, and which is not a bad thing, so long as it doesn't devolve into nationalism, which is what they were against. And they, a lot of them spoke out against the uses of these ideas by Nazis, and later on by neo-Nazis and white supremacists and white nationalists into today. And we get these problems still. But we go back here to the core sort of ideas of Lord of the Rings. And Lord of the Rings is about, in many ways, the futility of war and how much pain it does cause and how much pain it can cause. Frodo's journey is very much the idea of the journey of Tolkien. You know, there are basically two protagonists within Lord of the Rings. There is Frodo and there is Aragorn. And Aragorn is Tolkien's attempt to capture the idea of a mythical or legendary king. He's King Arthur. He's Beowulf. He is this aspiration, and one that in many ways succeeds in his aspirations to become the king of Gondor and Arnor. And he is this sort of pedestal. But then you see in scenes him very much so acknowledging that Frodo has carried far more than he has. That Frodo has carried the weight of the entire world in that small ring that he carried across. And it's a parallel or a metaphor for the horrors and the psychological weight that one carries when they come back from war, when they come back from seeing horror like people did in World War One and in World War Two by extension, in every war, specifically World War One, because that is Tolkien's personal experiences. But this idea is lost on a lot of people. It's lost a lot. You know, people focus on the battle scenes, and people focus on, you know, the good guys winning over the bad guys, and they forget that while the Lord of the Rings does have very clear ideas of what's morally good and what's morally wrong, there's also a lot of nuance in there with regards to what should be done, what needs to happen. And again, there are a lot of problems with the depictions of specific groups of people within his world. And, you know, going deeper into it, Tolkien himself sort of, you know, had problems with these ideas in as in what they what they could be seen as by people, and how they could be twisted. Because of his experiences with seeing how the Nazis twisted these things. And these are things that continue to be twisted till today. They continue to be twisted into different forms and made for ideas that people promote. This isn't necessarily people saying, ooh, Sauron's really cool, you know. This is more people saying, like, of course the men of the West won. You know, they are the ones who should have won. You know, this is it. It's a more nuanced way in which they twist the culture. But it's a problem that's in all fantasy that derives from very like Scandinavian or British sources, you know, Anglo-Saxon ideas of fantasy. And we see that, you know, Lord of the Rings is incredibly famous, and it forms the sort of foundation for a lot of modern fantasy. And in a lot of modern fantasy, writers take those foundations and they take them in the directions that the Nazis had took them. And that's why you see a lot of white nationalism and white supremacy mixed up with the ideas of northern fantasy. And, you know, this specific talk is partially inspired by some classes that I'm taking this semester. specifically medieval studies class, Digital Valhalla, where we talk about medievalism with regards to Vikings, specifically in video games, but to talk about video games a little bit, Skyrim and the Elder Scrolls Saga, which is very directly inspired by Tolkien, has in it, Skyrim has the Stormcloaks, who are Nords, who are, mixing my fantasy games together with those words there, that's why I slipped up. The Nords have like sort of a Nord supremacist front, essentially. In the actual game, it's a little bit more nuanced, but the way it's been taken, especially within specific right-wing groups, like the forums on Stormfront and these other white nationalist forums online, it's been taken as sort of a rallying cry and also like a depiction of them within fantasy. And this comes back again to representation as well. Only representing the core ideals of a very small group of people does a lot to embolden the people who think that they are better than others. And there's a lot of problems there, unfortunately. Well, I shouldn't say unfortunately. There are a lot of problems there. And the problems don't need to be there, I don't think. I think that diversity and going back to the second episode, diversity within fiction and within our stories, within fantasy and in science fiction, can only do more to show that the world is not just Scandinavia and the UK. It is a lot of places with a lot of stories, with a lot of deep, rich history that can all be shown on a smorgasbord of what humanity is. And showing more and more of those other things within our media can only open people's minds to what is truly out there and the possibilities. Because at the end of the day, limiting yourself to Scandinavia and the UK can get boring. And that's why we see more fantasy becoming famous now that breaks out of that box. Unfortunately, the biggest fantasy franchise right now is probably Game of Thrones, something that doesn't really break out of that box, being essentially, you know, George R. R. Martin's idea of how the War of the Roses happened in a fantasy world. But I think George R. R. Martin himself is he's very aware of these things. You know, he has spoken out against a lot of far-right movements, and I think he's aware of where he, like Tolkien and like C.S. Lewis and like the Inklings, is aware of how these things can be twisted. And he has a love for those things. And there's a reason why they're, you know, famous, and it's because of Tolkien's work and how much of an effect that's had. But I think he's carrying on the tradition of Tolkien well in the way of, you know, writing what he loves, but also making sure that what he loves doesn't influence people in the wrong ways, in the ways that he didn't intend to, or that people are twisting. All right. Well, that was a long, rambling talk about Lord of the Rings. I'm going to stretch. Oh, have some more of my coffee here. Now, I said at the beginning I was going to talk about two fandoms and one genre. And I've gone through the two fandoms, which is Star Wars and Lord of the Rings, two of the biggest fandoms, I would say, in nerd culture. And now I'm going to talk about a genre that's a little bit more obscure, but has been gaining more traction lately. And I think in some ways it's been in good ways, or in good ways, that was weird, in positive ways. But in some ways, people have been missing the point. Back to the title here. I'm going to be talking about dystopian fiction. We're going to be talking about George Orwell. We're going to be talking about Bradbury. We're going to be talking about why am I forgetting the authors of the other two books I was going to talk about? I'll just go to the titles. Okay, we're going to be talking about 1984. We're going to be talking about The Handmaid's Tale. We're going to be talking about Brave New World. We're going to be talking about Fahrenheit 451. 1984 is probably the most famous one. I sort of ordered this in, I don't know if I ordered it in layers of famousness or if I just, first one came to mind. To some degrees, that is layers of famousness in some respects. Anyways, 1984 is the story of a world in which an oppressive surveillance state controls what people think and controls what people are allowed to have access to. And it's very much so based on what George Orwell saw after the fall of the Nazi apparatus, and by extension, the Italian one and the Japanese one and the other sort of fascist states that were aligned with those powers. He saw what was happening in these things, and he wrote a book about it. He wrote a book in a fictional world about it. The Handmaid's Tale is about a patriarchal, totalitarian, and also theistic state by Canadian author Margaret Atwood. I looked them up while I was going through this stuff. Essentially, it's about a world where women are forced to be handmaids who are used basically to produce children for the leaders of the ruling class of the nation in which The Handmaid's Tale takes place, the Republic of Gilead. This is Margaret Atwood's response to what she saw as religious Christian extremism. And it's in many ways also a work of feminist literature in which she sees, gender inequalities and is addressing those within the world. Brave New World is by Aldous Huxley, and it talks about how capitalism can run to massive extremes that creates social hierarchies that are so rigid that people are biologically put within these social hierarchies. And it additionally talks about psychological manipulation, conditioning, and reliance on addictive substances. And finally, Fahrenheit 451 goes deep into the idea of book burning and censorship. And Ray Bradbury creates for you a world where books are all burned by people who have a job to burn books, and evokes ideas of the era in which he was living during McCarthyism, when the U.S. government was attempting to devise what was right and what was wrong for people to learn within schools, and was burning books and getting rid of these things. These are all, I want to very clearly say that dystopian novels are not predictions. They're not what the future could be. They're social commentary on what the here and now is. And all four of these books are just as relevant today as they were when they were written. People still try to burn books today. They try to censor things. People have arguably become more reliant on addictive substances and on things that make them blind to the horrors of the world around them. Capitalism is in its late stages. Organizations like the CIA, MI6 here in Canada, CSIS, are actively watching and listening to everything that we do. not to mention corporations and how much they are listening to what we do too. And finally, you know, gender equality has not been achieved. And there is a growing source of Christian religious extremism in the United States, which manifests in many ways in white nationalism. All these things are social commentary, and using terms like Orwellian or dystopian in ways that refer to these books as somehow predicting the future, or is some sort of tool to try to limit state power, is wrong. Each book that I talked about is specifically talking about like specific issues that are important to the writer themselves. You know, Bradbury was actively anti-McCarthy. He hated the idea that any books were burned, that you could censor people's ideas. And this is a debate that's gone on for a long time in the past, you know, and in many ways, some people take the wrong approach. You know, people who have ideologies that would be 100%, that would be very fine censoring other people, cry that they are being censored. Brave New World and the pandemic go very hand in hand with corporations making tons of money while everyone has to stay locked in their homes, while you know, uses of alcohol and drugs rose dramatically because everybody was terrified and frightened and they needed an outlet, and so they found their soma of choice, which is a thing from Brave New World. If you've read the book, you get it. It's fine. Read the book. It's a really good book. The Handmaid's Tale speaks to both attacks on women that have happened over the past couple of years, over a long time, I should say, but specifically that have been getting more and more recognition lately. In the United Kingdom specifically, there have been a lot of instances of gender-based violence, so much so that people have been pushing to have those be declared hate crimes, which, in my opinion, they should be. But in the opinion of the more right-wing United Kingdom government, they aren't. You could say that's probably because their leader with the terrible hair is a bit of a misogynist himself, but that's just throwing gasoline on the fire. And I don't like him, so screw it. And back again to 1984, he was just seeing how active George Orwell was, seeing how active surveillance was within the Nazi apparatus, and seeing the beginnings of those things that we now see more and more today. He wasn't predicting anything. He was just seeing what was around him and showing a world that he thought, you know, a world where this sort of thing was blown out of proportion. And we're living in that world nowadays. That doesn't mean he predicted it. That just means he was warning us of the problems that come with state surveillance long before we decided to listen to them. That's not prediction. That's just education. That's just opening your eyes to the world around you. And a lot of these go hand in hand. Brave New World's ideas of rampant capitalism, which they call Fordism, which if you don't see the ideas of that and how those ideas sort of exploded in now in our world today with, you know, places like Disney and Amazon, which create like whole communities around their areas. I don't know what to tell you. And combining that with the idea of state surveillance and fascist and authoritarian regimes which we're getting more and more. You know, they go hand in hand to certain degrees, you know, like corporations spy on us just as much as governments do. And corporations make a business out of it. They make money off of it instead of just collecting our data for no reason like the governments do. Well, I guess not no reason. You could make an argument. But again, that's the problem with these things, is that there are discussions to be had among all these things. But yeah, the problem comes when people try to think of these as predictions, because it puts these ideas further away. It makes us think that they're in the future when they're here right now and right today. They're social commentary at the end of the day. They're not predictions. You know, Orwell and Atwood are not soothsayers. They're just open. They just have their eyes open. They just saw the world around them and saw what was happening around them and wrote about it. And the fact that those things continue, the fact that those novels continue to be social commentary to this day, means that people have missed the point of it. They've missed the point of what they were trying to say, because there's still issues. I mean, I think it's getting better. I hope it's getting better. But it might not have had to have been if we had listened to it. And if we start to listen to it now, perhaps it could be better for people in the future. And I think that's the important message that dystopian novels have. That's why I love dystopian novels, is because they are social commentary, because they dig deep into the problems of our world today, and they allow you to see a world within your imagination that seems way too real and way too close to what we are now and what we have been for a long time. And seeing those worlds allows us to try and think of a world that's better than it is now. Think of a different world, a positive world. I wouldn't say utopian, because I'm not 100% sure that a utopian world could exist, but a fairer world could exist. A fairer and more equal world. And at the end of the day, that is what dystopian novels are supposed to inspire you to do. They're supposed to inspire you to reflect and change, so that you don't end up in a world like any of those. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good note to leave it on. I have been Kiefer again, and this is Radio Nerd. If you would like to talk about today's episode, or either of the previous episodes or any future episodes, feel free to either send an email at radionerdwlu@gmail.com, or comment on posts on radio_nerdwlu on Instagram. Feel free. Like I said before, this is always a conversation, and I would definitely love to hear what anybody else thinks of these things. So feel free to reach out. Have a good day.